Well, let me finish. Is anybody here didn't get their paper last time? 11 of you to be exact, if that's correct. All of you, do we know? Katie? Delph? Lisa? Chris? Chris Weintraut? Joanne? Schreiner? Brianne? Brianne? Shane, Laura, Anna, Tony Caldwell, Ariana, Morgan, okay, I didn't say anything. I guess I didn't say anything about the papers. Obviously, the grades were lower than you'd like, but that's the way it goes. That's all I can say. If you improve, we forget all your past sins. So for those of you who think you're getting an A without writing an A paper, you're not. All right. But the second paper, you can hand it in. You will get the same comments that you got on this. You get them way in advance, you take it home, incorporate them. Think you got it wrong still, hand it in again. All right, and I won't give you a grade on it, all right, but I'll make the comments on it. So if you're writing a paper, you should know when you've got an A paper, because it's sitting right on your desk in front of you. If that's what you want. You're looking at it, I'm looking at it. It's not an exam, no pressure. Wait till the next day, look at it again. Okay, it's no excuse for handing anything in but an A paper, if that's what you want. Okay, so. Yeah, lots of time. I changed the due date on the syllabus that I sent you last night. Did you get that? New syllabus came out in the email with the corrections. You may not want to wait until the last week to do all this, okay? You can get started anytime. I'll try and put together another blurb on the second paper, but essentially it's just the first paper again, just pick different works. Incorporating at least something from the middle of the term. If you want to read ahead and read the Montaigne or something like that, that's fine too, all right? So I would just structure it as some kind of comparison and stick with a text, stay off the internet. You know, I just pick it up right away. But all I want you to do is have an idea and read the text and give me some examples, follow it through. Show me that you open, say you're reading Chrétien de Troyes, you know, show me you read it, right, a little bit, that you can weave your little magic argument around it. Okay. You want to compare Chrétien and Beowulf? Perfect topic. I like comparisons because you can't find them on the internet. Right? They usually don't. There's not that many people assigning compare Chrétien and Beowulf out there. All right. So this keeps you writing yourself. I didn't add up the, I suppose you guys like to know the grade distribution. I forgot to add it up. 8 A's. 8 B's. 10 C's, a couple of D's, and F. All right. That was the papers. So, got room to go up if you want to. I know I always sound mean, and this is where I lose the class and get all my bad teaching evaluations, but what the heck. Might as well bring you into the process here. We get these forms that you fill out. You know, you do these things at the end of the semester. And I thought I just, for the first time, since I have the internet going and now it's online, we're asked to pick questions that should go to evaluate the class, and they give you 600 questions, and the professor is supposed to pick 20 of these. Well, it obviously strikes me as an insane system. I think the students should pick the questions, but that's not how it's done. They ask us to do it. So I thought I'd ask your opinion on which ones you want me to, which ones, when the day comes at the end of the semester in the last week when these things come, that you want to evaluate me on. This is your chance to get back at me for all the hateful things I've done to you all semester. And I thought we'd go through it. Let's just try and do this in about 5 minutes. And I don't want to be too scientific here. And I'll mark down the ones that there seems to be agreement on. I also, if there's one that you want to get me on, but you're sure that I'll know it's you and I'll hate you. Why don't you just write a number down on a piece of paper? Just write a piece of paper and hand it, you know. I'll leave the room or something at some point. Do we need to do that, or is this okay? Let's see. I want to have the ability to have anonymous too. But I mean, it always struck me for years, there were 600 questions. There wasn't a single question. Did you learn anything about how to write a paper? Which is essentially all I do, except yak up here in a class. And nothing was, there was also, did I make you feel good? And I always do terrible on this, did I make you feel terrible when you answered a question in class? Did I embarrass you in front of your peers? And, was I incomprehensible with the grading criteria understandable? Well, anyway, you see any ones up there you like yet? Can you read these? I think you're supposed to pick one or two from each section. And some of them obviously don't apply to an English class. But 16? Lectures are consistent. Anybody wildly opposed to me putting down 16? What is it? Lectures are consistent with the subject matter in the course outline. I think I usually talk about the work. So that's good. What is it? The content of this course is consistent with the objective. That'll catch me every time, I tell you that. We'll put that. You got to have objectives, huh? All right. I'm going to be thinking about that. 52? Oh, boy. I'm in trouble. See, this kind of question just kills me because, I mean, we're talking about Beowulf here. We're talking about a monster named Grendel coming out of the fins and getting his arm ripped off. So I don't know about this. I think, you know, there's the whole trend to go out and you guys should be teaching the populace of Lafayette. You should be engaging with everybody instead of just taking a class and going home and playing baseball. That seems to be what college. 24, 25. Well, I think you got to pick one of those. They look the same to me. So. Well, which one do you like? 25 and 26, and somebody you want 24. What about anybody else? Do you want all of them? Is that all right? Okay, 24. Yeah, I mean, this is a little heavy on that early stuff. Well, hang on. Let me just show you just where we're going here, and I'll come back. Team teaching, discussion, technology, course materials, feedback, exams. Well, we'll get there in a minute. And then broadening student outlook and personal social growth. I mean, I'm supposed to pick 20 of these, right? So I suppose I could have. So I think we got course structure goals, teaching, learning. Do we have one there? We have 52. Let's take one. Organization and clarity of presentation. Anything you want there? All right. You want those spot quizzes? All right, I get you. I mean, obviously, I like the exams rather than the daily quiz. I think, in my view, is why interfere with your life? You know, you got a busy week, but by the time of the exam, you should have made time for me at some point. Okay, but it's not up to me to say Tuesday and Thursday's, you know, my day. But that I'll put it in there. 136 field trips. Well, you see, we didn't go to see Joseph and the Amazing Dream Coats. There's still time for a field trip? Actually, we did. No, wait, we had Professor Weinfield. You made it all the way over to Stewart Center. And I didn't have to pay for the bus. I mean, I put, 89? You want? Anybody else? Does that seem covered already? What? I'll take it. Let's see. There, let's go down and... Team teaching is out. Well, discussion. I'll get a big zero on that one, so let's look. There's the big loser. Pick one. I'd sort of, you know, if it was me, I'd do that. I ask questions, but I don't wait for the answer. But you can, 149. Yeah, all right. Who said that? Who wanted to fail? What? All right. It's your shot. Let's see if I care. This is payback time. I don't think anybody pays attention to this anyway. But you got there's some online service that racks us over the coals pretty well. Anyone else? How about those instructional methods? Can I make this a little, let me see if I can get it down. Oh, you can't read it now? Oh, okay. You want 200? Well, let's see, we have to sort of go up and down. I'll just pan it back up to instructional methods. How about all these videotapes? I spent all summer making those. You guys, don't I get any credit for that? Yeah, guest speakers. See, they're not up with the technology. I used to bring in guest speakers, but it's such a pain in the neck. It's easier to put them on tape. 130? Okay. I can see you want to move into discussion in the second half of this class. After spring break, it's all discussion because that's where we can do that. Dante's a good place to start then. How about provide help? No? Right? What do you think? You want them to put it in there? I don't know what it means. This is a bunch of 261? All right. We'll do them both. All right, 261. What was the other? 248. You want another one? I'm going to do as many as you want, really. Excuse me? What number? Oh, you want to see it? Hey, believe me, when I was assistant head 10 years ago, I put the stereo speakers in here with a separate thing. It's not up to them. Now this isn't head, she doesn't know anything about technology, so these things are always breaking, but I was the guy who installed those speakers. Purdue would not put anything in this room because they said the ceiling was too low. It took me 5 years to get them in here, to get a projector. Works fine as far as I can see, right? I don't get it. I like the speakers. You can really crank them up, but they put a block on them that kills me. These things are really, really boom, but they've got some thing that keeps you from, you know, really playing them. So what do you have? Any 192? I hear 250. Okay. So, no, I only got about a dozen. Need about 8 or 10 more. I mean, I can take as many as you want. Should we go there? You want to go to the bottom and work back up? What? Exams? I love this. Where's that impartial?
I hate you.
I'm singling you out. You're in the seat of death. Like Lancelot in the cart of infamy. What? 289? Right? That seems fair enough to me. $296. I'll put it in before I even look at it. You guys, well, how can you teach? So you either, if you know all that stuff, the exam's got to be long, right? It's contradictory. How can I be accurately? You know? I mean, the key is, in case you know, if you're worried about the midterm, read this story. Even if you can't answer my question, you can start talking about the story, you know, and usually say enough to get most of the points. I think I do a pretty good job on divergent viewpoints, but I don't let you say them in class, that's all. Let's throw that in there. I mean, I'm not hiding. I won't duck from the tough ones. All right, 348. What? Scroll down. Right. Yeah, we're only halfway through here. Light on the comments? Why is that? Yeah, I was so always so lazy. I just didn't seem irrelevant, but last year I figured, I'll take the, you know, the professor who got the top teacher award, and I'll just use her question. But I haven't looked to see how that came out. I haven't looked at last semester's thing. It takes me a year to look at these things. It's too scary. It's like 388. 371. The workload is appropriate. 378. I got two people. Oh, 378. So let's go there. Uh-oh. Now it's all about you. All right.
You better. You're going to die.
And if you want to talk about your paper, just email me. We'll get a time. Probably Wednesday, but it could be any time. $417. I mean, you can disagree, but you think it's a good question. But we're not. How about a number of 499? No, 498. Throw that one in there. Anything else? Well, I would hope that 488 would be something you'd do, so I'm going to put that one in there. If you read these things enough, you listen to those videotapes enough, you'll start to figure out how to read. You're not doing research papers, so it's not performing arts, there's no labs, no clinic, no distance, no service. All right. Can we drift back? Right? You think it's good? All right, that's enough. $3.99. There's a five questions that are mandatory to cover that. I'll throw it in anyway, but you'll get it twice. There's one just like that. But let's put it in anyway. Since you mentioned it. Right. Yeah, there's five mandatory. I forget what they are. Okay, let me go back to Kraken a little bit and review what was important last time. I'll try and put together a sheet of paper with the minimum first lines. I would like to go back to this notion that you could come out of here with a little bit of a lot of languages and some words from around the world. The problem, I sat down to do it this morning, and that Arabic tape, I couldn't find my text file that I used to do the subtitles in the Arabic tape. And it was so difficult, and I don't know where it is. And so I get stopped cold, and I don't know when I'll get to it, but in the next couple of weeks I'll try and do it. We talked about... Chrétien, and I made the point that this is an example of the romance form. Knights, ladies, dragons, we've all heard of them. We've heard of King Arthur. This is a very popular style of writing in the Middle Ages. This whole unit is the Middle Ages, right? The first exam was the classical period. We're now in the medieval period. And then after the third part of the course will be the Renaissance, right? In the medieval period, the romance, generally about a knight just takes off on the road and goes somewhere and runs into a series of adventures and maybe has one big quest. All right? Quest and adventure is the pattern of the literature. All right? Very popular form. Today, or 50 years ago, you could say the most popular form of literature was the novel. And people read Hemingway and they read Fitzgerald, the Great Gatsby, and now probably film is pretty well taken over from the novel, and maybe even film has died, and the television series is the dominant form of art. But in the Middle Ages, it was the romance. In fact, TV series are kind of like romances. It's sort of endless stories that you can keep adding on to. Chrétien was one of the people who invented the endless story. The Percival story keeps going on. Other authors continued it. People tried to explain what that grail was, that thing that Percival saw go by him. And it just exploded. We really don't know what was going on in Chrétien's mind. I tried to explain very quickly that the part of the popularity of Arthurian romance was the French educated ruling classes liked to read this stuff because King Arthur they saw as the figure who made their presence in England legitimate. Right? They had defeated the Angles and Saxons, they had defeated the Germanic tribes that occupied England. And by the end of today, we hope to go back, it was slightly out of order, to Beowulf, which is a product of those Germanic tribes written in Old English. And I'll explain it. Maybe one other thing. There's a novel named called Ivanhoe by an author named Sir Walter Scott, who wrote in the 19th century. Ever heard of him? It's a Walter Scott. There used to be a TV show called Ivanhoe's. Does it show up on Ivanhoe? This guy with a horn, sort of a Robin Hood type guy. In fact, it's a real Robin Hood story. Ivanhoe's always running around in green tights and and doing things. But Scott says the story takes place. Ivanhoe is a Germanic figure who is in England when the French take over in 1066. And Scott points out that the distinction still lasts down to our day today. If you are somebody living in England, speaking a Germanic language like Old English, very Germanic language, okay, and you go down to your pigsty, you've got an animal in there called a swine. That swine is the old thing the Germanic word for pig, right? But when the French overlord says, "I want some, pork for dinner," right? He uses the French word for the pig, which is the pork, P-O-R-C. So on the table, it's pork because the rich guys get to eat it. In the barnyard, it's a Germanic swine, and you don't get to eat it because you're just a slave, right? And the same thing is for the other big animal. For the lower classes who don't get to eat meat, who have to just eat barley, they have oxen to pull the plow. But when they serve it at the table, it turns into French and becomes de bœuf, or beef. Okay? And that distinction sort of still lasts. And you can see how the French combined with the German and produced English. Right? And this process took 300 years. Well, Chrétien represents the French side. I said page 1327 is the key in your introduction. He's telling stories about King Arthur, who was a figure who was pretty much made up by Geoffrey of Monmouth for these political purposes. And in this particular story, it's a spiritual story. And you can argue it goes back to the Odyssey. He's probably got his eye on some version of the Odyssey, because we can read Odysseus's life as just working his way home and defeating those suitors. But everybody asked, what's it about? And I've been trying to suggest people read it allegorically as the progress of the soul, as kind of a learning experience. So when somebody sets out on the road now in the Middle Ages, they're not just trying to get home physically. They're trying to learn something or achieve some goal or reach some emotional state or spiritual state. Right. In a kind of Platonic sense, in other words, elevate themselves spiritually and in the background be worthy of going to heaven. So we sort of feel that with Percival, that he goes out into the world of adventures and is trying to learn something, trying to make himself better. And what we really see is him making a lot of mistakes, because that makes for a more interesting story than having just a saintly person. But way off in the distance, you can feel there's a word called the Pilgrim's Progress in England, in English, where pilgrim sets out on the road and goes through the Slough of Despond and goes to the something of vanities. What's the Vanity Fair? Goes to Vanity Fair and eventually becomes a good Christian in that story. So page 1327 talks about Percival's problem of being one of excessive literalism. He does exactly what his mother says without thinking about the circumstances. He kisses the wrong woman. He takes a ring. Then when a guy tells him not to ask too many questions, he forgets to ask questions at the most important time. So I want to just weave through the story really fast and pick out a few. I think you can read this on your own pretty well. Page 1334, if you just want to mark things. At the bottom of the page, this is where Chrétien goes into a tent and he finds this woman lying on a bed. This is the romance landscape. It's just a fairy tale landscape. This is the girl. He takes her ring and he kisses her, and then her boyfriend will come back and get really angry at her when she doesn't have the ring. Well, Percival is such a moron that he goes into the tent thinking it's this thing his mother told him about called a church. And he finds this woman lying on the bed. Says, "Wow, I like these churches." Right? That's the tent adventure. Then on page 1336, he gets to Arthur's court. And it's here where he gets made a knight. And he runs into Arthur's right-hand man, who is Sir Kay. And Sir Kay is really mean. And he sees this bumpkin kid come out of the forest. But he's obviously of good parentage, because he's really huge. And the implication is some wandering knight had knocked up his mother, so that he's, you know, that's where he gets all the muscles from, because he'll win all his battles. Well, Sir Kay is really mean and makes fun of him, but some horrible person has stolen King Arthur's cup, and King Arthur's going, "Oh God, somebody took my cup," and then he spilled the wine on the queen, and what do I do? I'm so helpless. I'm old, and Sir Kay is just sitting there laughing at him. And Percival comes in and says, "Well, I'll take care of it if you make me a knight." And a little woman over in the corner, in a Cretian-like scene, the woman who had never laughed, the woman who had never laughed smiles when she sees Percival. And it makes Percival happy, but it makes Kay, who's so mean, really sad. So he socks her right in the jaw, right in front of everybody. Right. Brutal violence. By Sir Kay. Well, you know that Percival at some point has got to get Kay back for it, and eventually he does, all right? But first he goes and defeats the Red Knight who had stolen that cup, right? And a fool predicts a great adventure for Percival, and that Sir Kay will get paid back for hitting the girl. So, jumping along, 1343, we get to the second episode, which features this guy he runs into by a river. His name is Gournemont de Gohort. Okay? And the man recognizes that Percival is rather foolish and he needs education. So the education theme isn't that far to find. And the guy says, "Look, kid, you look smart to me, but we need to go to school. And in this school, we learn horsemanship first," and he teaches them how to ride. "Then we learn how to use our weapon," and he teaches them how to use a spear. This is what these knights always use, according to the fiction. You know, there wasn't a lot of knights riding around with spears in actual battles in the real world. In 1170, the main weapon was a crossbow. Okay, so you could show up in your armor and your spear, but it didn't do any good against the crossbow. Okay, very high velocity. The only thing that made it not too deadly is it took a lot of time to rewind it. Right? But it took 300 years before the famous English longbow in 1450 replaced the crossbow as the deadly weapon. And that's why we had the Hundred Years' War. A good longbow man could kill you at 200 yards, which is really pretty remarkable. Okay? But it took a lot of practice. Anyway, so this is the lesson where Gournemont de Gohort teaches him things, dubs him a knight, fastens on his spurs, tells him that he must be chivalrous. This is page 1344, somewhere in there. And so that's a lesson. You know, a knight has to be good. So you see, you're taught morals. This doesn't come to you. You have to be educated. And it's fascinating in these medieval stories that morality goes along with learning how to be a soldier. Right? This is the ideal of chivalry. Now, let's just assume it's just that and not think about the reality behind it. But it was a very powerful idea, and will last right through Don Quixote in this course. Okay, by the time we get to Don Quixote, this whole notion will come under fire. Well, then he gives him some advice and tells him not to be too talkative. He tells him to help ladies in distress. He tells him to go to church. And he tells him, "Don't go around telling people, 'My mother said I should do this. My mother said I should take your ring. My mother said it's okay to kiss you.'" He said, people don't want to hear that. Okay? So that's pretty interesting. The next adventure, the thing about talk is right in the middle of 1344. No one can talk too much. Right? Don't talk too much. He meets Blanche Fleur. the archetypal lady in distress. At the castle of Beaurepaire, on page 1347. Well, as we're getting there, we'll notice on page 1345 that it's a land in distress. It's like a wasteland. It's really like Thebes when the plague hit it. Right in the middle of the page, you see no mill was grinding or oven baking in the whole town. Things are bad. And basically, the ruler has been killed, and they need somebody to take over. And there's just this lady trying to run the town. But, and this is a fairly typical situation. A lady whose husband went off and got killed in the Crusades was stuck. I mean, she just couldn't run the political system. But, you know, she had to find somebody to marry. Well, she's being besieged. And we can almost feel the Odyssey in the background here. These medieval romances sort of replay the classics in a very loose way, because these authors did not know the classic texts that we read today. They knew dim versions of them, but Homer just didn't exist as a text for them. Well, there's this guy named Clamadou besieging her town, and Percival comes in and basically rescues her. But first he embraces her and kisses her, and they kiss a lot. On page 1352. Then he goes out, having kissed the lady a lot, and defeats her enemy and sends him off to Arthur's court. And back at Arthur's court, that's page 1354, Arthur's sitting there, as he usually does in these stories, refusing to eat until an adventure appears. "I'm so hungry, but it is my custom never to eat," says Arthur, "until an adventure appears." And this adventure is the defeated knight comes in and tells them all about how well Percival is doing, that kid that had gotten into a tussle with Sir Kay earlier. This is the setup for lots of Arthurian romances. Now, if you're an English major and you take English 240, you read the most famous one of these. It's called Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Have you ever heard of that? All right. And that one, there's King Arthur trying to, "I'm so hungry, but I never eat until an adventure comes." And this guy on a green horse with green armor and green skin comes in and says, "I'm here." "I challenge Gawain to a little exchange of axe blows." You know, this sort of taking shoulder punching up one notch, right? "You get to swing at my head and I get to swing at yours." Right? And Gawain swings and cuts off the Green Knight's head, and it falls off, and the Green Knight reaches down, puts it back on, and they all go, "Whoa." So we get the main theme of Arthurian romance, which is magic, and the other theme is love. Right? Those are the two things. That's what people went to these stories for. Right? There are other stories. The only other theme is battles. Right? And in the Middle Ages, it was usually Charlemagne who fought, because he was always fighting against Islam, basically. And love, nobody cared about love, and they didn't care about magic. They just wanted to kill people. Right? These things actually came together with a poet named Boiardo, but he's way beyond this course, and we won't get into him. So that's Beaurepaire, where Percival helps this lady. And there's the scene that everybody likes the most in these romances. Percival is sleeping alone at night before the big battle, and what happens? She comes tiptoeing down the hall. Oh, those happy sounds. Even Don Quixote experiences this on his first adventure. Okay, except it's not a woman coming down and some guy comes and beats him up. He thinks it's a woman. He goes, all nights, all they have to do is get to a room and the little footsteps come and boy, and this guy comes in, whack, whack, whack. But Don Quixote's always making mistakes, right? The next big episode, 1356, is is the Fisher King. Okay, and I talked about this. This is where he sees all these mysteries. He sees this infirm old king. He sees a bleeding lance. He sees the candelabra going by him, and he should have asked the questions. Right? So I'll let you look at that. I'm sorry that my tape isn't on DVD. I can't jump between episodes. I still want to show a little bit of it. Then we get the episode of the Proud Knight, 1362. And what happens is, Percival, the lady that Percival kissed, he runs into again. And she's wearing rags because her boyfriend thinks she's a whore. And he's making her walk in front of his horse, and he's prodding her with his lance. And she, you know, there's holes in her clothes. And I won't get to that part, but you might want to get this movie. It's pretty good. Okay. Very French, that's all I got to say. Nice depiction of this. Well, anyway, Percival defeats this loutish knight and sends him to Arthur's court with a message for the lady that Sir Kay hit, and to tell her that the lady who never smiled will be avenged. Then there's a scene on 1366, which I want you to think about. This is a really good one for... anybody wants to do their second paper, an interpretation, just a comparison, a kind of poetic comparison, not really stuff we've talked about. This is a poetic moment, very much like those Chinese poems we were doing. So 1360, it's the goose or the geese episode. Percival's riding along. Again, it's just another adventure. There's really no connection in these adventures, just one adventure after another, right? But we try and make sense of them. And here he sees a falcon swing and kill a goose. And he sees the goose drops 3 drops of red blood on the white snow. And Percival goes, dung, into this trance. What's it mean? Dung. It reminded him of the skin of Blanche Fleur back in Beaurepaire. So he's obviously been in love, but has had no concept of how to do anything about it. Didn't ask rather on a date, and so let's go hang out at Steak and Shake. You know. And he's got no concept. All right. But that you know, that meditation on the natural scene, right? That, you know, in my imagination, it would be very similar to the River Snow poem. With the old man fishing, and here you have a Fisher King, and you have the river snow, and I keep trying to connect the sense. You think it's the same poetic sensibility, but they kept the people I was interviewing kept saying, "Nah, completely different." And I don't know. I could leave it to you. That, and the Chinese, you might even do a little research on it if you wanted to do that thing. In that case, because I don't think you'll find any. I know you won't find a paper comparing Chrétien de Troyes and Tang Dynasty poetry, but there are 300 other poems out there you could read if you were interested. Anyway, at this point, Arthur comes riding up, and they've been looking for him. They find Percival in this trance, and Sir Kay's such a lout that he starts to make fun of him, and so Percival's doubly angry at Sir Kay. First, Sir Kay had hit the woman who never smiled, and now he's interrupted his trance, right? Meditation on the floor, okay? So he whacks Sir Kay and breaks his arm, okay? And everybody's really happy, and they have a big party because Sir Kay's so mean, and he's taking care of him, all right? Then you get that's page 1366 to 1370. And then you get this episode on 1370. Out of the middle of nowhere, an old woman, a hag, appears to Percival. Let's just read that. This is the second full paragraph. Let's start three sentences down after the space there. Right at the top, like line 5 on the page. On the third day, they saw a damsel come riding on a tawny mule with a scourge in her right hand, that's a whip. Her hair hung in 2 black twisted braids, and if the book describes her truly, never was there a creature so loathly, save in hell. Her neck and hands were blacker than any iron ever seen, yet these were less ugly than the rest of her. Her eyes were 2 holes, as small as those of a rat. Her nose was like that of a monkey or a cat. Her lips were like those of an ass or an ox. Her teeth resembled in color the yolk of an egg. She had a beard like a goat.
In the middle of her chest rose a hump. Her backbone was crooked. Her hips and shoulders were well-shaped for dancing. That's ironic. Her back was hunched and her legs were twisted like two willow wands. Her figure was perfect for leading a dance. Into the king's presence, the damsel urged her mule. Never had such a creature come to a royal court. She gave a general greeting to the king and all the barons. But seated on her tawny mule, she addressed Percival alone in these words. Ah, Percival, fortune is bald behind, but has a forelock in front. A curse on him who greets or wishes you well, for you did not seize fortune when you met her. You entered the dwelling of the Fisher King. You saw the lance which bleeds. Was it so painful to open your mouth that you could not ask why the drop of blood sprang from the white point of the lance? When you saw the grail, you did not inquire who was the rich king whom one served with it. Most unfortunate is he who, when the weather is fairer than usual, waits for even fairer to come. This is the medieval version of a tragedy. It's not like Oedipus making wrong. Well, he made a wrong decision, but boy, he's sure catching it here. She's an image of fortune, and this is replayed throughout early literature. I mean, right up, we're not getting to do Hamlet, even though Hamlet's in this book, but this figure of fortune as a woman, there are many attributes and many ways of showing her, but basically the idea is you don't catch her and she gets away. You got your chance, but you miss it. Okay. She turns her head. Fortune smiles at you. You go for her. She turns away. You walk. Right. In this case, she has a long forelock. Fortune is bald behind, but has a forelock in front. You can catch her by the hair while she's facing you, but if she turns around, you're going to grab her hair, and your hand's going to slip off the back of her head because there's no hair. Okay. You got to seize your opportunity. Very medieval moral, and once you missed it, you are dead. It's all lost. Downhill for you. Okay. Very medieval, this notion of fortune just, you know, you're either up or you're down. I'm not saying life is like that, I'm saying this is the way medieval literature likes to work at it. We're Americans, we like to go back up. but it's very powerful in the story. And it sends Percival off, really kind of thoughtfully, and the story breaks off, and we don't know where he goes. So he goes off on a quest on page 1371. Let's do the second, just before the paragraph before the break there. Percival spoke otherwise and vowed that henceforth he would not lie two nights in the same lodging, nor avoid any strange passage of which he might hear, nor fail to engage in combat with any knight who claimed to be superior to every other or even two other knights, until he could learn whom one served with the grail, and until he had found the lance that bleeds, and he had heard the true reason why it bled. He's going to learn this stuff if it kills him. And he never does it. The story breaks off, right? There he is. That's the search for the Holy Grail, you see. You can see how it starts, and you can see how Kratian kind of hides the meaning. And you can see a Christian guy coming along and say, well, it's obvious to me what that is. This is the search for Jesus. Okay? And that was very powerful reading, but it's not necessarily the one that's here. Right? The spiritual search is non-denominational, I would say, in this story. Right? Non-denominational, however other people might read it. So he's off on a quest, and then at the bottom of 1372, he runs into this worthy man again, whose name is another worthy man, and we don't need to know too much about him, and he confesses to him why he's off on this quest. About a quarter of the way up the page on 1372, sir, I was once at the house of the Fisher King and saw the lance of which the point truly bleeds. But concerning that drop of blood which I saw hanging from the white steel, I did not ask. And ever since, I have fared ill. Nor do I know whom one serves for the grail which I saw. And since then I have endured such sorrow that I would willingly have died.
I forgot God, and I have not implored his mercy, and have done nothing to my knowledge to obtain pardon. He's a lost soul. But I submit to you, this is his saying this is a kind of act of confession. At least he knows he's a lost soul, right? At a time when confession became a centerpiece of the Christian liturgy. It was not before. I said, this is written about 1190, and by 1215, there was a papal thing called the Fourth Lateran Council, and confession became a requirement. And so it's in the air. The medieval church changed a lot of stuff. And this is the same time the whole notion of purgatory is invented. Right? It doesn't exist before. It's a very medieval addition to heaven and hell, this notion that there's a third place. All right? So that's that. Well, I guess I'll forget the tape for a while. Let's do the Beowulf. Maybe we'll have a pizza party someday. Get my evaluations up. we can watch Percival. But let's go back to Beowulf, and I'm not quite sure why I skipped over. It may have been this. This is a story about set in Germanic society. Okay. We're talking northern Germany, southern Sweden. Page 1174. We'll start. And it says Beowulf, circa 9th century. We just don't know when it's written. Right? 9th century would be, say, 850. It's 200 years after, Muhammad goes to Mecca, after the founding of Islam. It's really the Dark Ages. The Roman Empire is a disaster. And we're up there among those German tribes who crossed the Rhine and took over. This is such an interesting work. We have so little that came from this period, but it's all, you might not catch it in the translation, but it's all of unbelievable brilliance. Right? This Old English poetry has this mournful sense of loss and doom that's really unexcelled in world literature. For a little tiny place, it just leaps out. It's right up there with anything else produced around the world. So you can, it's not necessarily English literature. It's more Germanic. But there's two things going on. One, it seems to be composed around 850 and has all the values of a German tribe, of life among kind of Viking lifestyle, where the values are physical strength and helping your friends, distributing money if you're a king, getting drunk, basics, right? And a good burial. Right? Die like a man and get buried and put out to sea, right? And women are okay, but they're basically good for helping male friendship get along. I give you my sister, now we're buddies, right? So we don't get too excited about it. We're not looking here for modern role models, people, right? But we're getting a glimpse of a world that's otherwise fairly invisible because it was essentially a non-writing world. And Beowulf is a fragment of, clearly there were oral poems going around, and somehow this got written down. But it didn't get written down for about 300 years, maybe 500 years. Just like Homer. Remember, Homer was being recited, and finally the guys who invented the alphabet and the brilliant grammarians in Athens in around 850 BC wrote it all down, and that's the text we have. Somewhere along the line, Christianity was organized pretty much by, had established a network across Western Europe, even in the worst times. There were a lot of isolated monasteries, a lot of monks living alone, and they didn't have TV, they tended to copy stuff out. You sat there on a long night and just copied stuff. And now the scholars are saying, actually, we could probably prove a lot of these copyists were actually women, right? So you had women involved in these monasteries, too. Not in the same one, but that would cause trouble. And we'll get to that when we get to the Renaissance. But you had people copying stuff out. So it looks like what we have in Beowulf is a story written down, or in a version that comes from about 1150, of in other words, after, long after the events that take place in it. Tolkien, you know, your Lord of the Rings, right? You help your friends, you give away money, and the thing you give them is rings, gold rings. Just as the Greeks, this was a metal working culture. Right? And I should, you know, I could, let's take a random, we have unbelievable gold artifacts that came down. I'll just go Wikipedia. What do I need to do to get pictures? Okay, so Sutton Hoo is a famous, in England, they actually found a Viking ship. And it was full of gold artifacts and stuff. So, I mean, this stuff really existed, right? And they find rings and hair nets and stuff like that. So if you look up Sutton Hoo and you track it, you can get some really nice pictures. We used to, there's a tape over in the library about this stuff. Right? Now, what's the story of Beowulf? The story of Beowulf is there's this king named Hrothgar. And he's got everything you want in life. And we know right now that they don't need a lot, these guys, okay? He has, he's sort of ruling his kingdom in southern Sweden. He's got a mead hall. He's got a place where you can drink beer or mead. And he's got a lot of friends. So let me back up here, so I don't forget. Page 1174 of the introduction. When you're studying it, that's all you need. You can skip the rest of the introduction. Right? We're only doing the first third of Beowulf. But that page 1174, really, I mean, I should just read it out loud. It's well done here. It gives you the date. It talks about the nostalgia of the old English poems. It's a pagan world that's passed away. Everybody's kind of doomed. The values in the second paragraph are this loyalty between lords and warriors. And the worst thing you can be is an outcast living alone. And the best thing you can have is to take care of your friends and to die well. And at the end of the story, Beowulf will die and will get the proper Viking-type burial. It means he gets put in a ship and shoved out to sea. Any of you read The Lord of the Rings? So you're in Tolkien land. Tolkien was an old English scholar. This stuff has had incredible renewal of energy in the 20th century. Because the Lord of the Rings, and what does Hrothgar do? He gives out rings. And what happens to Frodo at the end of The Lord of the Rings? Right? He gets in a ship and he sails west. In other words, he goes to sea, just like a good Viking king. Even a little hobbit, you know, can be a true warrior. You don't need physical strength. That's the sort of spiritualized Tolkien version. And the most important thing is a loyal friend, right? So if you finish The Lord of the Rings and you're in tears, it's because Sam Gamgee finally, you realize that he's the true hero of the story. You hadn't realized it with you. Three volumes, oh my God, right? Well, these are the values. Tolkien was a professor of Old English, and he was supposed to be writing scholarly articles on this stuff. Instead, he was writing The Lord of the Rings, or inventing all kinds of words and lists of names and runes. And C.S. Lewis kept saying, "This is so boring. Why don't you just tell a story?" And that's when he wrote The Lord of the Rings. So read 1174, and then on page 1177, right in the middle, you get a little summary about the Christian elements that have found their way into this poem. Okay. What we seem to have is an old oral Germanic story about loyalty and retainers and the good life, which is getting drunk every night with your buddies, but being told by probably some kind of monk who's clearly aware, it's clearly a Christian because there's enough references to God, right? And so I think the first thing I'll do is just run through a few of those. Line 106. Well, just to go back to the story quickly. So Hrothgar's sitting in the meat hall and all is well, and then he's attacked. And he's attacked by this guy named Grendel, who comes and just sort of eats his friends. You know, he comes out of the swamps of Sweden, and every night when everybody's trying to get drunk and be happy, somebody's reaching into the meat hall and grabbing Heather and taking her away, you know, and you're gone. Okay? And it's really depressing when that happens, right? So it takes the edge off your beer drinking. Okay. That Grendel, at line 106, is said to be a descendant of Cain, the murderer Cain who killed Abel. So we know we're in a world, you know, you have to be, because whoever's writing this down has to know how to write. And you can't know how to write in Western Europe without, really, without knowing Virgil, without knowing the Bible. I mean, that's what you were taught in grammar classes. So he knows the biblical story. Okay. Line 187, you see a reference to God and the King of Heavens. Okay. Blessed is he who after death can approach the Lord and find friendship in the Father's embrace. This is pretty Christian talk. Okay. I'll jump to line 670. Beowulf himself will, 670. And the Geat, that's Beowulf, placed complete trust in his strength of limb and the Lord's favor. Right? So he figures he's got God on his side. And while we're here at the bottom of the page at line 712, you can see God cursed Grendel. So Grendel's the outsider, and he's ravaging the mead hall, and along comes Beowulf to the rescue. Okay. He's not of Hrothgar's tribe. He's a Geat from another place in southern Sweden. Okay, and he comes to help the half Danes, whoever they are. All right. He shows up, says, "You know, this is just what I'm looking for. It's something that, you know, a challenge. A monster who comes in the night and kills people. Yeah, that's my line of work. You know, it's John Wayne type thing, right?" And in the passage you have, he kills Grendel. But to make it interesting, this follows all the rules of good storytelling. You know Beowulf's going to win, right? So you have to make it interesting. And he's in the Arthurian romance stories, you know Lancelot's always going to win. So he always gets shot in the butt by an arrow before a big fight, to sort of even up the odds, you know, where he loses his sword. Okay, here Beowulf says, "Well, you know, I'm going to fight this one barehanded. Yeah, I'm going to leave the sword home." Okay, Bunting, I think, is the name of his sword. I'm not leaving home. We'll take this guy, and he wrestles Grendel and tears his arm off, and he defeats him. Now, Beowulf is a series of three combats. You're not reading the second one. The second one is completely unique to Middle English, Old English literature. Somebody's really unhappy when Grendel's killed. Who is it? His mother. So Grendel's mother comes up out of the swamp, and Beowulf has to dive down under the lake and defeat her down there in her underwater palace. Okay? It's not the only place, I think, in world literature where oppressed women, the oppression of women is represented by putting them underwater. Okay? It goes right through Kate Chopin and right through Sleeping with the Enemy. If you're, to get away from your husband, you have to dive under the water, right, and swim away. I won't get into that. So that's the second adventure. Then 50 years pass, and Beowulf is the king. And everything's fine. But there's this sense that nothing's really fine. It's all transitory. It's all going to fall apart. The old world of getting drunk with the guys, it's just passing away. You can't live like this. And you can see why a Christian writer writing 300 years after is going to throw that nostalgia in. It's the period of the death of the old gods, the old pagan ways. And it's a sad moment always. This was played out in the 4th century in Rome as the old multiple gods died. Wherever you bring in that Christian God, there's this nostalgia for the old ways. Oh, God, it was so much more fun before I had to go to Sunday school. You know? Right? And you really get that sense of loss here. Well, Beowulf has been in power for 50 years, and another adventure comes. There's a mighty dragon guarding a hoard of gold, and he wakes up. And he starts, because somebody stole a gold cup. And there's sort of overtones of Judas and stuff like that in there. So. And the dragon is really angry. And he starts flying around and there goes a few towns. The old fiery breath. And Beowulf, 50 years later, has to rouse himself for the final battle against him. And he kills the dragon, but he dies in the fight. And he gets pushed out to sea. And you get this feeling, you know, there's just never going to be another guy who can fight a dragon the way old Beowulf could. And he doesn't leave any children behind. So you've got this kind of sterile society. It's all past. It's all worldliness. There's no future. So the values are coming in really kind of subtly in this, but rather unmistakably. Okay. So the poem considers a world when death was really the only reality. You died and that was it. You're doomed, and there's a despair to that. Okay. At least from a Christian perspective, which the author is writing from, but pretty mildly. That's what I mean. There are very few references to any religious text. It's not like Dante, who's quoting the Bible every 2 seconds. What we have is the author's perspective years after all this took place, and there's a feeling of sympathy and pity for the people in the story, okay? And how they have to die away. There doesn't seem to be necessarily any comment on what's right or wrong, right? There's not, I think that's the big thing, there's not really a questioning of values, except the one your introduction points out in the first page, which is this value of community. Somehow you want to, you want to stay together. Okay. And that would be, a value if you're a monk writing in 1150, you're living with a bunch of guys, okay, and you're not drinking beer all day, you're saying the mass or something like that, but you have that community. Right? And so that's a prized value, and that seems to be retained, but it doesn't strike me as something that's creating a sense of right and wrong necessarily. Right? A couple other things need to be said. There's a videotape on this with Professor Hughes, which you should look at. Okay. So, the language. And I realize I should probably jump up to Hamlet and talk a little bit about English verse. Because we're sort of aiming there, but I can't do it today. This poem is not in rhyme. It's not in meter. It's in what's called alliterative verse. In other words, each line has three words that start with the same consonant. Are you with me on that? They talk about it in the introduction on page 1178. Alliterate means use the same consonant. You find the word alliterate. And they give you one example on 1178. Off shield sheffing, shethen a threatham. So you get three SH sounds. And the line breaks in half. And Professor Hughes will talk about that a bit. I'm trying to just get you to know the first line of Beowulf. But, right? Whack, we yargain. I can't remember it. We guard Dana. There you go. What is it? What we yargan. You see why I sort of canceled that part of the class? I couldn't do the Chinese. Okay. All right. Well, you got my videotape of Professor Hughes, but you can go to that one too. All right. So it's alliterative. Right. And the other thing is that we like about Old English poetry is they do these double-barreled words. Okay. So if you look at line 10, for example. In the end, each clan on the outlying post beyond the whale road had to yield to him and begin to pay tribute. The whale road is a funny way of saying the sea, but that's part of the poetry. The whale, they put the whale together and the road. Swan's Road later on. Grindel's called the Heather Stepper. You get these two-part words. I'm not going to make too much of a heavy weather on it. Well, this prologue is, I remember them telling me in college how wonderful it was. Of course, it went right over my head. But it is pretty nostalgic. We start with the death of a king, being buried in a boat, being shoved out to sea, and the ice forming on it. It's really, really rather haunting. And it's an earlier generation, sets up the whole poem, which will end with Beowulf himself being set out to sea in a kind of boat like that. Well, there's a lot else to say, but let's do the page. Did the last thing, line 612. There's the woman who shows up. They're looking for the women in this. Wealthiau is Hrothgar's queen. And we'll see she's not going to get a lot of activity. Although Grendel's mother, isn't it? Fascinating concept. Line 612. Wealthiau came in, Hrothgar's queen, observing the courtesies. This is a formal society. You have to behave correctly. I mean, it's probably more formal than the White House is today. You know, people had rituals And as you read the poem, you'll see Beowulf land, and he'll meet a guard on the shore, and they will exchange formal speeches. Right? And they'll recognize that each one is an important person because he speaks really well. He knows how to address people. He knows what to say. He understands the situation. Speech is everything. Right? This is not, great moments in presidential speeches. Right? This is... These are real speech. Well, Wealthiau herself observes the courtesies. Adorned in her gold, she graciously saluted the men in the hall. Now, we don't get the speech, but we are told that she speaks well, and she knows how to speak to the people. And, of course, she does the right thing. She gives them a drink, right? And she passes the cup around and in this kind of ceremony. So everybody, gets to sort of partake a little bit of her presence. And she's very well dressed. With lots of jewelry, and there's not Dante. Nobody's complaining that she's wearing too much makeup or too much jewelry. It's assumed it's a good thing. Okay, it shows that the husband's got some money, right? And he gives it to his wife, right? And there you go. See ya. Have a nice break. Read your Dante, and so that's where we're going. We're going to hell right after the break.